Hello everyone, and welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly news roundup podcast, where we take a critical look at a number of topical developments from the past few days with a leadership and management theme. I am Rob Jones, content manager at the Institute, and in this podcast we will be looking at news from the week beginning 3rd of June. Joining me to analyse these stories is Kate Cooper, Head of Research, Policy and Standards at the Institute. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Rod.
Our first story notes that burnout has been officially recognised as an occupational phenomenon in the latest revision of the International Classification of Diseases published by the World Health Organization. Burnout is a syndrome conceptualised as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. It includes low energy or exhaustion, feeling removed, negative or cynical about one's job, and a tendency to feel less competent. Kate, with the advent of the World Health Organization's definition, what should leaders learn from their acknowledgement of the mental and physical effects of burnout?
It's important the WHO has recognised the effects of burnout, and although it sounds as though this is a relatively new phenomenon, I think it's been around and so many people will identify with some, if not all, of those symptoms. It's traditionally been associated with people in very high-powered jobs, high-paid executives who have got the whole burden of running the organisation. But as we can see from this, those symptoms can apply to any one of us at any stage in our careers. Those of us who derive a great deal of potential satisfaction, but also identity from our work, I suggest would be more prone to over-engage with work and then to be so self-critical when one feels that one's not delivering to the standard that we'd accept. So line managers, colleagues do need to be on the lookout for people who seem to be more self-critical, who seem to be working longer hours, who seem to be lacking that energy that perhaps they used to have. So often it's about a comparison with what somebody's normally like that we then notice when they're behaving abnormally. So getting to know the people you work with, knowing what their normal is an essential starting place.
Thank you, Kate. This report actually follows a recent BuzzFeed report where burnout was particularly highlighted as a problem for so-called millennials, that is, people born between 1980 and 2000. I'm joined today by two millennials. Juliet Campasi is going to discuss with Kieran Kang whether they think millennials are particularly at risk from burnout.
Hello, Kieran.
Hello.
I'd like to ask for your opinion on why our generation is under more pressure than previous ones.
I believe social media has a big impact on our generation being under more pressure because we start to see other people's lives and we compare our lives to other people who seem to kind of have it all together and they have a very glamorous life or they seem very successful and happy, and we may put that pressure on ourselves to achieve that life. So I believe that has a really big impact on today's generation.
Thank you, Kieran, and over to you, Rod.
Our second story considers whether hiring managers can revive career break talented individuals who may be apprehensive about rejoining the workforce. Chief People Officer Amanda Cusden from the accounting software company Sage outlines the thinking behind the firm's Pathways initiative. She explains that people who have taken time away from employment tend to think that their experience is outdated and that companies will look unfavourably at the gap in their CV. However, Amanda takes a different view. She suggests that diverse backgrounds, including career breaks, develop innovative thinking, which is highly attractive to us. She goes on to say that we needed to let this group of people know how valuable their experiences are, and Sage has deployed newspaper articles, radio interviews, and Facebook ads to raise awareness of the Pathways initiative, and has also invited interested candidates to an open day at Sage's Newcastle HQ and provided support to help them manage potential issues such as imposter syndrome and personal branding. Kate, what can other recruiters learn from this thoughtful and sensitive approach to recruiting career break talent?
What people returning to the workplace after a career break for whatever reason often forget because they're so worried about whether they've kept up to date with technology, and we hear how things are changing, that their ability to form work relationships, to work with others, to understand organisational politics, they don't go away, they're enduring, and they are the key skills, those human skills of emotional intelligence, of empathy, that they're bringing with them. I think what Sage has done here is recognised that there's so much more to attracting talent than just posting a job ad. You have to encourage people to sell the idea that your company's a great place to work, to let them know that you'll support them right from the beginning, and to recognise the huge differences in people's expectations of work, their levels of confidence, and that actually the employer can do something about that in advance. And what it's really going to achieve is for people to be more loyal to Sage, more committed, and for them to reduce the risk of making wrong or disappointing appointments.
Thank you, Kate. Now, our final article looks at a budget set out by the New Zealand Premier, Jacinda Ardern, on the 30th of May. The budget's essential argument is that GDP is not enough by itself to sustain a country's stability and morale. As such, it sets out five priority areas that it aims to tackle with generous public spending: the mental health of all New Zealanders, child poverty, Maori career prospects, digital innovation, and the transition to a sustainable economy. Ardern explained, while economic growth is important and something we will continue to pursue, it alone does not guarantee improvements to our living standards, nor does it measure the quality of economic activity or take into account who benefits and who is left out or left behind. Growth alone does not lead to a great country, so it's time to focus on those things that do. Kate, what can leaders of private and public organisations learn from how Ardern and her coalition government have reframed New Zealand's priorities?
We know that with any single measure, such as GDP, it's crude. There are going to be so many things left out. And if one looks at the overall well-being of a nation, it's certainly an indicator, because economic prosperity does lead to greater spending on healthcare, education, reduction in poverty. So I wouldn't for a minute suggest that we do away with it. But what she's drawing attention to here is how much more there is to being a successful and happy society, a prosperous and enjoyable place to live. And what she's done, and how complicated is that for any country to do, is to identify, well, what are the most important things to us as New Zealanders that we really care about and we're happy to be defined by and judged by. And that is bold in political terms. We hear in the UK how great a contribution volunteers make, particularly in the charity sector, obviously. They're not counted in GDP. And as we see the working week reduce with people with more leisure time, there are going to be more and more opportunities for volunteering, and we should be accounting for those. We should be accounting, recognising how important health is. Firstly, of course, because it could save so much money on our national health, but also an indicator of what the UK is like to live in, what our values are, and what makes it a great place to be. So any measure that recognises how much we leave out is important, but I'm not for a moment trying to suggest that what we put in its place is easy to arrive at.
And finally, Kate, can you tell us what's new at the Institute this week?
A great week for us at the Institute. We're launching our trust research, which we started as long ago as 2009. We're looking at how trust has changed, and we found out, Rod, that CEOs in the public sector are the least trusted of all. And surprisingly, those in financial services, their levels of trust have risen. But I think what's particularly good for all of our members is that line managers are universally more trusted than CEOs.
Thank you very much, Kate. And that concludes this week's episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section on the Institute's website at www.instituteLM.com And thank you once again, Kate, for your insights on these stories.